37. An area of high pressure will continue to build into the region this afternoon, allowing for mostly clear skies and a lighter wind. Dry conditions and cool temperatures will prevail across the Midwest into tomorrow. High temperatures this afternoon will reach the upper 30s to upper 40s across much of the Midwest. Low temperatures overnight will be in the 20s. The forecast for East Central Illinois this afternoon, sunny with a high around 40. The wind from the west at 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear, the low 25. The wind will be out of the south from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny with a high of 44. The wind from the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy. Expect a low of 28. The wind will be from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Friday, partly sunny. Look for a high in the low 40s. Friday night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. Saturday, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-40s. Saturday night, rain is likely. We'll see a low in the upper 30s. And Sunday's forecast, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and a high in the low 40s. At noon Central Time, temperatures ranged from the mid-30s to the low 40s across Illinois and Indiana. The skies were mostly sunny. At Rockford, it was 39 degrees. At O'Hare, 41. In Bloomington, 37. 36 at Mattoon. And Carbondale reported a temperature of 39 degrees. 41 at South Bend. At Lafayette, 36. 37 degrees at both Indianapolis and Terre Haute. At noon at Willard Airport, it was sunny. 36 degrees. The dew point, 25. The relative humidity, 64%. The wind out of the west at 8. The barometric pressure, 30.12. And falling. And at 12:39, 37 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The sky is sunny. When American Airlines reorganizes under bankruptcy protection, it is not likely to seek widespread layoffs. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports on where the airline is likely to cut expenses.
During the economic downturn, American Airlines already pared down its workforce. Analysts don't think there will be massive layoffs this time.
Many elements of labor are going to pay a terrible price for this.
Aaron Gelman teaches transportation at Northwestern University. He says the first place the company will likely try to cut is pilot salaries, and then...
I think there are also others who are quite innocent who will be... hurt in the long run as they cut costs, which they must do in bankruptcy. So I don't think it's a good thing for the workers at all. It sure is not job creation.
Gelman says pilots and mechanics are relatively safe, but he says customer service jobs will likely take a hit. James Ash is a forensic accountant. He specializes in bankruptcy. He says this bankruptcy is really about wages and other benefits.
What's clearly going to play out on this, and it's playing out all over the country, including in state and local governments all over the country, is trying to pull back on the liability associated with paying out retirement benefits.
Ash says reduced pensions, retirements that start much later, and higher health care costs for employees are likely to be a new picture for the friendly skies. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
This Friday marks the 10-year anniversary of when energy giant Enron filed for bankruptcy. The next day, thousands of workers in the company's Houston headquarters lost their jobs. They were given 30 minutes to clean out their desks. Since the company's demise, how have Enron's employees and the city coped? That story from Andrew Schneider of member station KUHF.
In Houston, many of the physical signs of Enron's presence remain, even if the name and Tilted E logo are long gone. Here in downtown, cars drive along Smith Street, right by a gleaming skyscraper that once served as Enron's headquarters. It's now owned by Chevron, one of the big oil companies that a top Enron executive once derided as dinosaurs. And this is one of many changes. CEO Ken Lay helped build Enron Field to keep the Astros from leaving Houston and to revitalize the city's downtown. He succeeded in both, though the stadium is now called Minute Maid Park. Less obvious but more significant for the city is what became of Enron's workforce. The company hired the brightest workers it could find. Those who came up with new ideas and were willing to take risks were rewarded. Those who failed to measure up soon found themselves on the street. It could be brutal, but it proved an ideal training ground for entrepreneurs. Adil Jafri joined with several of his Enron colleagues to start a retail electricity provider.
I believe that the value created by Enroners and former Enroners after they left Enron is a lot greater than what was embedded within that one company alone.
Phyllis Anzalone was a pioneer of Enron's retail electricity business. Like Jaffrey, Anzalone founded her own company. She looks back on her time with Enron as a positive experience.
My career at Enron was just the most exciting thing I've ever done in my career. And I would go back, I'd do it all over again, I'd be first in line. Even if I had to lose the money that I did, it was a very exciting place to work. I'd do it again in a heartbeat.
Anzalone says just about anywhere you look in the energy industry now, you find Enron veterans. But she also recognizes not everyone came out of Enron's collapse unscathed.
The people who were the closest to retirement and the retirees are the ones that you really had to feel sorry for because they were affected the most. They didn't have the time to get their earning power back. Whereas many of us were much younger and we could go and rebuild from there.
Houston was already in a recession in December 2001. Enron's bankruptcy made it worse. For workers young enough to go back into the job market, having Enron on their resumes was no help. It took Max Eberts a year to find another full-time job.
It seems like I was called in for interviews because people were curious more than anything. They all wanted to know what happened, what it was like. And there was even some questions if, you know, did I know in my position? And of course the answer was no.
Employees not only felt let down by Enron, but ripped off, and they fought back, forming the Enron Employee Committee. Through lawsuits and out-of-court settlements, the group recovered about $35 million. Many people in Houston knew someone who lost their job because of Enron, but as Mayor Anise Parker says, that's Houston's history, not its present.
The fall of Enron was significant to the city of Houston in many ways, but Enron wasn't Houston and Houston wasn't Enron. We're a big city with a lot of strong corporate leaders. It was a blow, but the city is stronger than Enron, and we move forward.
Today, much of the U.S. is struggling with slow growth and high unemployment, the painful aftermath of a financial sector meltdown that made Enron's collapse seem like a hiccup. Meanwhile, Greater Houston is adding jobs faster than almost any other metro area in the country. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
It's 12:45. This is the Afternoon Magazine. The wide-ranging inquiry into criminal abuses by the British press has led to testimony about relationships and careers damaged by tabloid excess. Newspapers owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp are at the heart of the scandal. A former features editor for one of those papers stole the show at yesterday's hearing. NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
Most journalists testifying before the inquiry have followed one of two paths. They've either been reflective about needed changes or defensive about the importance of a free press. Not former reporter Paul McMullen. For him, it's been a great ride.
I absolutely loved giving chase to celebrities. I must admit, it was, before Diana died, you know, it was such good fun. I mean, how many jobs can you actually have car chases in?
Diana being Princess Diana, killed back in 1997 after a car crash in Paris, her driver speeding to escape paparazzi. McMullen is the former features editor of Murdoch's now-shuttered News of the World. And yesterday, he functioned as the British tabloid trade's untrammeled id, dismissing the very idea of privacy.
Privacy is particularly good for paedophiles, and if you keep that in mind, privacy is for pedos. Fundamentally, no one else needs it. Privacy is evil. It brings out the worst qualities in people, brings out hypocrisy. It allows them to do bad things.
McMullen said hacking into cell phone messages, bribing police for confidential information, and other illegal practices are perfectly acceptable when reporters are trying to get at the truth.
I have a huge amount of cynicism for both Hugh Grant and Steve Coogan, who have really done rather well with their careers by banging on about their privacy. You don't need to do that. All you've got to do is to jump off the stage for 5 minutes and people lose interest in you very, very quickly.
McMullen says he's driven by anger at the past editors of News of the World, Rebecca Brooks and Andrew Coulson. Both had built up close ties to Prime Minister David Cameron in his rise to power. McMullen, unrepentant, called them the scum of journalism, not for the abuses he says they approved and knew of, but for failing to stand behind the journalists carrying out their assignments. Other witnesses have testified to the bruising power accumulated by Murdoch's tabloids. BBC News presenter Ann Diamond had asked for privacy for the funeral of her infant son and was distraught that the son splashed photographs on its pages. Diamond testified a top Sun editor then sought her help in a public campaign against Sid's deaths and wouldn't take a no.
And then he said, well, we're going to do it anyway, whether or not you join with us in doing it. And frankly, it'd look very bad for you if you don't.
And how did that make you feel?
Emotionally blackmailed by the people who I felt had just trampled all over our dignity, all over our child's grave.
Nick Davies' reporting in The Guardian broke the phone hacking and bribery scandal wide open. Davies testified about his disillusionment with the media.
I do not trust this industry to regulate itself. And I say this as I love reporting. I want us to be free. You've got a huge intellectual puzzle here in front of you. How do you regulate a free press?
British lawmakers are expected to take that question up after reviewing the inquiry's findings next year. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Usually, trouble at school means a trip to the principal's office. In Texas, it more likely means a trip to court. Zero-tolerance policies have some school officials worried about their students.
The unintended consequence is that their education suffers to the point where it puts them farther and farther away from graduating.
Rethinking Student Discipline in Texas, that's today in All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
WILL AM 580 will be off the air Friday, December 2nd from 9 a.m. until about 1 p.m. while our transmitter power supply is connected to the U of I's underground utility. This phase of our tower work will help make AM 580 more reliable in bad weather. Thank you for your patience throughout our tower repair project. AM 580 programming will be available at will.illinois.edu.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 30th of November, 2011. It's the birthday of Jonathan Swift, Dublin, 1667, author of Gulliver's Travels, the story of Gulliver journeying to exotic places, meeting all kinds of strange creatures, including a disgusting race called Yahoos, which he eventually realizes are humans. A few years later, he published A Modest Proposal for Preventing the Children of Poor People in Ireland Being a Burden on Their Parents or Country and for Making Them Beneficial to the Public, in which he proposed that the children of poor people should be eaten. He wrote, "A young, healthy child, well-nursed, is,